Session number 12139. Rule 9.
General breathing, rule 9.
Yes, the Yoka people who had been captured were got hold of by this chap and made to promise, one way or the other, that they would now be on our side. I suppose you could say they were traitors to their own people in a way. But we also promised them that when what we were trying to do was over, that they would, if they wished to, be taken out of Cyprus with their families and transplanted to Britain or Canada or anywhere else that they wanted to, if they felt that their lives would be in danger in Cyprus.
How were they persuaded to defect?
Well, the alternative was to refuse to do what we wanted them to do, which was to act on our behalf.
But were they given money or something in order to induce them?
I think in the end they were given some money, and of course they were paid, sort of rough to the same as policemen or soldiers would have been at that time. But a perfectly good, reasonable number of these chaps volunteered. I think in those parts of the world you change sides more willingly than you do in some places. And they probably reckoned that perhaps life in America or somewhere like that would be quite a good idea. And anyway, what this chap did was he formed a squad, which were changed every now and then, the actual members of it, and he would lead this squad, and they would wander around the countryside and appear in a village, which they knew was frequented quite often by Ioka gangs. And they'd go and sort of sit and drink coffee, and they'd be dressed exactly like any other Ioka people, and they'd have the same sort of weapons and that sort of thing, which had usually been captured from Ioka. And then some stage they'd say to some of the locals, well, have you seen any of our friends around here? And usually the answer was no. And then one day they'd say, oh yes, some of your people are in the next street, just up there, drinking coffee. And then we always had nearby, when this sort of thing was happening, a platoon, not more than sort of half a mile, perhaps a mile away, linked with radio, with this bogus Ioka gang. And these chaps would go around and a shooting match would start. And then the platoon moved in, and then a little bit further away there'd be a company ready, and then the company would come in and surround the village, and then we'd see what we could get out of it. And this only worked about 1 in 10 or 15 times. Either there was nobody there or somebody was suspicious of our little bogus Ioka gang. But it succeeded enough times, and the locals, Greek and the villages in Cyprus, actually were getting terribly sick of the Ioka people, because the Ioka used to take everything they wanted in the way of food, drink, anything else from the locals, animals, and so forth. A lot of the villagers were coming to the conclusion that it was better to back us than it was to back the Ioka. So, again, our people had to be sort of fairly careful, because it got to the stage where villagers were reporting to our soldiers somewhere else that there's an Ioka gang in the village, and of course it was us. So we had to be reasonably careful. But this went on to the stage where we we captured, in fact, this was captured by us, by Tupara, not by this chap's gang, a fellow who, an Ioka chap who talked, and he had quite sort of good recent news, and he told us where a certain chap normally lived, and he lived in a sort of cellar down under somebody's house, that sort of thing. Well, we captured him, and he was the sort of quartermaster, you might say, of the Ioka army. Who he supplied them with the weapons and the wherewithal to get them and that sort of thing. Anyway, eventually, and this is the sort of the final coup, he gave information about somebody else who was one of the very leading top Ioka men, Polycarpus. I don't know whether you ever heard the name, but Polycarpus was the man. And all of us, all the officers and the NCOs, had a little booklet which gave photographs of all the leading Ioka chaps. And Polycarpus was about number two or number three of all of them. And he tried to ambush this leader of the Burgess Ioka team once and failed. But anyway, the next thing we got was that the Burgess Ioka team captured a chap who again talked and said, I think I know where you will find something of value to you. And so I can't know why, but when I heard this, so often when you get intelligence, it's only one in 10 or 15 times that it's of any use. And this time I thought it sounded a good one. And so I thought I'd go along and see what went on myself as well. And it was like a film. The chap who said he knew where an important fellow was came along with a sort of team of people, and then very quietly, I think we used most of the battalion to surround this village, and we finally arrived at the house that this chap had said, and so then they searched the house, couldn't find anything. There was a woman with a child in her arms sitting in front of the fire, everything looking frightfully peaceful, couldn't have been better. And so we were shaking our heads and we said to this fellow, are you sure of this? Yes, yes, he said, this is the house. Well then, somebody, and you've got to be sort of very careful on these occasions, somebody noticed that in the fireplace, at a part where there should have been ashes, in the fireplace, there weren't ashes, and you could see a sort of rift between the stones. And that sort of guess seemed to give a clue. Anyway, they thought that it was worth investigating. So the good lady and her baby were transferred into another room somewhere. And the fire was swept away, and sure enough, there was a great block of stone, which is the top of a trapdoor. And so they got this out with some difficulty because it was rather hot. And, of course, there was the top of a ladder. And so then somebody shouted down in Greek, you better come out, otherwise we're going to throw a bomb down. And in due course, and we all stood back, as I say, exactly like a film, sort of watching to see what on earth is going to happen. And up they came. I think there were six of them. And number one was Polycarpus. And I must confess, I rather take my hat off to him in a way, in that when he got up, and he was sort of blinking because he'd been in the dark for quite a long time, when he could sort of see properly, he peered around and he saw the leader of the bogus Ioka gang, and he looked at him and he said, "Ah, Major so-and-so, how nice to see you." And this is the chap he'd been trying to ambush. Then he was put into captivity, and in fact, he was let out later. And I think he was the chap who started going in an adverse direction, so to speak, to Archbishop Macarius. And I seem to remember that after that sometime, Macarius did what all dictators do, and Macarius was a dictator of a sort. He had him shot, and he disappeared.
Did he speak to the major in English or in Greek?
In English. And the other six, three of them were in the top category, and so we reckon that was a fair success. But in fact, that part was after we had been involved in the Suez campaign. Our Cyprus thing was split into two halves before Suez, and then we had to go to Suez. And then after Suez, the other two parish towns went home, but we stayed in the mountains. And that's when this recent thing I was talking about happened. As far as the Suez thing went, we had about a fortnight to 3 weeks to prepare for it, and it's extraordinary how you forget about war and you think you revert to peace very easily. And I knew suddenly when I was told in a fortnight's time you will be probably up against the Egyptians. They may or may not be very good soldiers, but they've got perfectly good modern tanks and artillery and things like that. So don't think that you're just going to have a walkover. You've got to fight just as hard as you would be fighting anybody else. And then it came home to one that you'd got to take a second look at your battalion. Well, I reckon I'd got a pretty good battalion. But I still, having looked at them again, I thought to myself, well, so-and-so and so-and-so, I think there were two people who I reckon weren't really up to this, that they could let the thing down and wouldn't be able to control their soldiers as well as they should, etc. And it just shows that in peacetime even, one should be looking at one's unit with the eyes of what would happen in wartime. And you cannot keep people who are either too lazy or too they aren't tough enough or something, that unfortunately you've got to clear the decks and only keep people who you reckon will give their soldiers the maximum amount of encouragement and support and leadership that is needed. So that happened, and we sailed off in this great convoy to Suez, and eventually we landed, it took an awful long time. We'd never know to this day what all the delays were. We sat in that boat for most of the day, and we didn't land until the afternoon. And as I say, I cannot think what the delay was. Nobody's ever been able to find out what it was. But there should have been somebody. The whole thing depended on speed, really. Meanwhile, the third Parish Battalion had done a very good job on capturing Gamel Airport, which was the airport there, and the Marines had gone and done a certain amount of sorting out amongst the relatively few people who resisted in Suez itself. And we landed and marched through Suez, getting sniped at a bit. And then we got down to the southern end. And then we had, at that time, we had no transport. But we stole transport, I think. We got lorries and buses and things. And we were supposed to have a squadron of tanks with us, but the tanks, again, I cannot understand what happened, but the tanks didn't seem to want to move. So we said, well, we're going to move because we've got to get down the canal as quick as possible. And so we went on, and at, I can't remember what time, but I think sometime in the evening, about 6 or 7 o'clock, still light, we'd arrived at a place only about 2 or 3 miles from Ismailia, as far down as that, where we were stopped. And this is a signal telling us that there was going to be a ceasefire, and we were to stop now, and a complete ceasefire will take on from midnight, etc., etc. And we wondered what on earth for, and that sort of thing. And this is a thing which has never been really pursued, and nobody can find out, because I think that the message has been destroyed. But for instance, General Tony Farrar-Hockley, who you will know, he was the DAA and QMG, which is the administrative officer, the chief administrative officer of the brigade, of the parachute brigade at that time. And the brigadier was Brigadier Tubby Butler. And they saw this signal. I saw the signal, and the signal was shown to me in order to stop me, so to speak, from going on further. And in it, the signal said words to the effect of, more or less, that you will stop now, wherever you may be, you will cease fire in any way from midnight, and this is most important because there is a danger of Russian rockets on London and Paris. Russian nuclear rockets on London and Paris. And ever since, I've thought to myself, what a message to send troops in the field. If we'd gone on for another even 48 hours, we would have probably saved an awful lot of trouble for the next 10 years in the Middle East. And it reminds me, actually, tremendously, unfortunately, of what has recently happened in the Gulf. If we'd gone on until Saddam had gone or been blotted out by his own people, we would have a great deal less trouble in the Middle East than we will be having now.